From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, President Trump summoned private sector executives to the White House to say he will impose tariffs on steel and aluminum imports next week. It's a little calmer, though, today than yesterday when the president called his Attorney General Jeff Sessions disgraceful, told lawmakers you're all afraid of the NRA, and called for gun control as Republicans looked on dumbfounded. This morning, that's been walked back, the president tweeting out, respect Second Amendment. But also yesterday, White House Communications Director Hope Hicks announced she's stepping down. Let's bring in NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, this was a day after Hicks testified before the House Intelligence Committee, said she occasionally told white lies for the president. CNN reported that he berated her after that. But still, this had been such a solid supporter. Lots of people have left. How different is this that it's Hope Hicks?
Well, it's very different that it's Hope Hicks. You know, there's been some 50 people or more who've resigned or been fired as staffers from the White House. Four communications directors in a year. That is just stunning. It's a huge number, very unlike other administrations, Republican or Democratic. But it's big because it's Hope Hicks, because she is somebody who had been close to the president, somebody who had been a true loyalist before the before coming into the White House. She's sort of one of the last loyalists who had been with the president for a while outside of the family. So this turnover in the White House has really now gotten to a different level.
Well, and when you say the family, even some of the family roles have been reduced, because we heard the news this week, of course, about Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and senior advisor, stripped of his temporary top secret security clearance, and then reports of his family business getting loans after his White House meetings with heads of corporations. You know, it feels as if that there might be an exit, or there's been at least a reducing of a role. What does this mean for this president in particular, not to have these people around him?
Well, he continues to say that he's the only one that matters. And when you treat people that way, then they start to believe that, especially if his ire is pointed at them. That's a big deal when you're thinking about having enough staff, qualified, competent staff around you to be able to help do the spade work that needs to be done in a White House. They're important. But if they feel like they're not, and they don't want to be around the drama and the chaos and the backbiting, then they're going to leave.
Well, that brings us to Attorney General Jeff Sessions. President Trump lashed out at him again yesterday. Now we have to back up and remember that FISA warrant request in the Russia investigation and charges that it was politically motivated. Sessions sent the investigation into that question to the Inspector General. President Trump wanted the investigation done in the more Trump-friendly Justice Department. But how long can this public humiliation go on? And why doesn't the president just go talk to him instead of tweeting it out?
Well, a couple of things there. I thought you were going to say, why doesn't the president just fire him rather than humiliate him on Twitter? Because that's where things you would think would be moving. As far as talking to him about it, he apparently doesn't have a lot of respect for him at this point. You know, reportedly he'd been calling him Mr. Magoo behind his back. And so, you know, you've got a president who, even though this was somebody who, we're talking about Hope Hicks as a loyalist, Jeff Sessions was the only senator to endorse President Trump or Donald Trump when he was running for president before any other senator would jump on board to do so. And yet he's willing to poke his ire at him. And this is all goes back to that Russia investigation. He didn't think that he should recuse himself from that investigation. He did. He felt like that opened the path for a special counsel and what we've got. The reason he probably doesn't go out on the limb and fire him altogether outright is because if he fires him, then staffers at the White House tell him, what do you do next? Do you fire Rod Rosenstein? Then what? Then who do you put in place? Can we deal with the political backlash that comes from that? So he is stuck in a position that he feels like he shouldn't be, and maybe hoping that Sessions will just resign on his own, but yesterday decided he was going to stand up for himself and say as long as he is Attorney General, he's going to do it with dignity.
Look, we have to talk about the president's comments about the NRA. He was talking to a room of lawmakers who, I mean, the facial expressions were really quite something.
They were.
And at one point, he addressed Senators Pat Toomey, the Republican of Pennsylvania, and Joe Manchin, the Democrat of Virginia. They have a gun control bill together. And the president specifically asked about whether they would try to raise the age to buy assault-style or long guns, they're called assault-style weapons, which is now at 18, to 21, which is the same age for, you know, things like Glocks and other guns. Here's Trump with Toomey.
I'm a big fan of the NRA. They want to do it. These are great people. These are great patriots. They love our country. But that doesn't mean we have to agree on everything. It doesn't make sense that I have to wait till I'm 21 to get a handgun, but I can get this weapon at 18. I don't know. So I was just curious as to what you did in your bill.
We didn't address it, Mr. President. Look, I think
you know why? Because you're afraid of the NRA, right?
Okay, you're afraid of the NRA. We didn't address it. I mean, that, he must have been stunned to think that a Republican president would want him to address it. What's going on here? Is this maybe, you know, it's such a message mess, but maybe that's what's needed, a bowling ball in the form of President Trump to hit these pins that haven't moved?
Well, a bowling ball is symmetrical and travels in one direction unless you put a spin on it. This is like wobbly and all over the place and doesn't hit any pins if that's the case. So you're not sure what you're getting is my point. This is like Bizarro World out of Seinfeld. You know, it looked like a presidential meeting. Everybody was wearing the right clothes, but it was nothing like a normal presidential meeting. President Trump was so far off on his history with when it comes to the gun control legislation that you don't even know where to begin, really, because Toomey's bill was not a comprehensive bill. To accuse him of being scared of the NRA hated his bill.
Yeah.
So a lot more there.
The president at one point said, let's take guns away. NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, it's been a dry winter in much of the U.S., and that's raising concerns about a possible repeat of 2012's drought. That was the worst since the Dust Bowl, and it cost farmers, ranchers, and governments $30 billion. Harvest Public Media's Madeline Beck reports on the early signs of yet another drought.
Ken Schaefer's farm is in the driest spot in Illinois.
This is the first winter I can remember not having to wear boots. I don't like wearing boots that much, but being dry is another thing.
He's showing me around his family's farm in Jersey County. It's the southwest part of the state, just north of St. Louis. Schaefer has cows.
Oh, baby's nursing.
But he and his brother also farm hundreds of acres of soybeans, corn, and winter wheat. He says this is the driest he's ever seen it in winter, even drier than in 2012, when the drought really took hold in late spring.
In 2012, we at least started with some water in the ground. You know, I've dug some post holes this winter, and it's just dust.
While the weather is out of Schaefer's hands, he says he can plan out how he plants and...
We're going to have good crop insurance.
When natural disasters like droughts occur, crop insurance payouts are huge, and the federal government tends to pick up most of the tab. In 2012, insurance payments were more than double recent averages, costing the federal government $12 billion. The U.S. Department of Agriculture reports varying levels of drought covering most of the nation. It's especially bad in Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Colorado. And it's spreading in areas already hard hit, like Southern California, the Dakotas, and Montana. But that doesn't mean this growing season is a bust.
I mean, there's nothing to say that we couldn't turn it around with, you know, a wet month or two.
That's Jim Angel, the Illinois state climatologist.
We've had a couple of years where it looked like we're going to have a drought, and then it gets wet in the spring and all concern goes away.
But Angel is concerned about the dry conditions, especially because there's a similar, unusual pattern to the winter of 2012. He says there's been two La Nina winters in a row, meaning everywhere but the Northeast and Northwest sees mild and dry conditions.
So there again, it doesn't guarantee anything, but it is an interesting coincidence.
Overall, though, he says climate change is driving more sudden, heavy rainfall events in the Midwest. But in western states like Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico, storms and rainfall are fewer and farther in between.
And then there's some expectation that's the way it will move in the future, that we'll continue to get wetter and they will continue to get drier.
In southwestern Colorado, there's a town called Mancos. That's where Dustin Stein, a young farmer in his 30s, has spent the last few drought-riddled years as a cattle rancher. In fact, his first year on the ranch was 2012.
That's one of the challenges of young and beginning farmers is that we don't have the historical experience of how bad this year is.
He says droughts make it hard to grow enough grass to feed the cattle, which in turn means
you're forced to sell off your assets in a way that helps you keep your other assets alive.
Stein says young farmers have to adapt. He's even growing hydroponic barley as spare feed. But adapting only goes so far when it comes to Mother Nature. So Stein will keep tabs on grass as spring arrives, because dead grass is a bad sign. Jim Angel, the Illinois climatologist, says he'll know parts of the Midwest are in for drought if they're still dry through May. As for farmer Ken Schaefer in southern Illinois,
I kind of wonder if we have enough moisture to germinate seed right now.
He says he'll need some rain before April, but not too much rain. For Here and Now, I'm Madeline Beck.
And Madeline's story comes to us from Harvest Public Media, a public radio reporting project that focuses on agriculture and food production issues.
Schools in West Virginia are closed for the sixth day with teachers on strike. The Republican governor has agreed to a pay raise, but that still has to pass the legislature. And teachers say they have additional concerns that go beyond pay. Dave Mistich is senior reporter at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. He's in the Capitol in Charleston. And Dave, we've been hearing that there's a lot of activity there.
Yeah, again, once again, for, you know, days on end, it seems, there are thousands of teachers, school service personnel, other public employees, supporters of all those groups here at the Capitol. We've heard chants of do your job and all sorts of things literally every day, and they're back to that again.
So what are the sticking points? We know that the deal is offering the teachers an increase pay of 5%, which is substantial, but they have some questions about health care. So what are the sticking points?
Right. So pay is a big one. West Virginia ranks 48th nationally in the country, including Washington, D.C., in average teacher pay. Healthcare has been a big problem here. As of right now, the insurance program for state employees has a freeze on the on rising costs for the next 16 months. But teachers, the service personnel, other public employees say that that's not enough. And just yesterday, through an executive order, Governor Jim Justice called upon a task force to be created to research and to delve into this issue of health care costs to the public employees insurance agency.
Okay, but I just want to ask, what is the average pay for a teacher in West Virginia? Because we're hearing they work second and third jobs, they're moving back in with parents. What's the average teacher pay?
It's about $45,000 a year. That probably sounds a lot higher than, and it is higher than the average income for West Virginians. But I think a lot of what we're hearing is that these teachers work very long hours. They contribute money out of their own pocket to pay for things around their classroom or to help out students that are in need. So I think that, you know, even though that number is higher than the average salary of all West Virginians, the teachers put in the time and the effort, and they claim that that they deserve the respect to make more than that.
Well, Dave, we just want to ask you about, you know, the very nature of this. This is a teachers' union. West Virginia recently became a right-to-work state, meaning that employees who are not in a union don't have to pay the union fees. This is a huge point of contention. Unions say if we're representing you and if you're going to benefit from our negotiations, you don't have to be in our union, but you should at least pay the fees for the benefits. And now in West Virginia and other states that don't have that requirement, people can work without paying fees towards the union and still get the benefit of the union negotiations. And some have said that's part of undermining unions when people don't have to pay the fees. But what's happening here? Do you think this is showing that this teachers' union still does have muscle?
Well, you know, West Virginia is a really important place as far as the history of the labor movements involved. You go back to the mine wars, particularly the labor movement and coal mining here in the state. Hugely important. I think the narrative over the past few decades has been that the unions have been weakened. But I think that what we're seeing here in this movement is that counters that narrative that the unions are weaker. I should point out, and this is a thing that's been discussed around the Capitol, is that this movement, this labor movement, has been pushed largely by women. Of course, teachers, largely women demographically here in the state as well. And I also should point out that a rally on Monday of this week included the United Mine Workers of America and the AFL-CIO. Mm-hmm. So these teacher unions are aligning themselves with unions that have been particularly strong in the past.
Well, what's public opinion? 250,000 kids out of school for a week, parents caught up in that. What's public opinion?
We're seeing that's sort of a mixed bag. I mean, of course, it's an inconvenience to parents. There's a few that say that it's hurting them. They've had to pay for daycare. But again, there's also a large contingent of people that are very supportive of this that only see it as an inconvenience. So that's a mixed reaction there. And as things move on, I think you're bound to see a loss of public support. But for right now, people seem to be with them on this.
Well, this is a time when people have become painfully conscious of how important teachers are. David Mistich, senior reporter at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the Academy Awards are Sunday, and while the provocative German filmmaker Werner Herzog isn't up for an Oscar this year, critics and movie lovers list him high among the living masters of cinema. At 75, Herzog has more than 60 documentaries and features under his belt. He was recently honored by the Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline, Massachusetts. Andrea Shea from member station WBUR was there and has this story.
This is one of the rare times anyone, with the exception of two guards, is allowed inside the cave.
Werner Herzog has given us glimpses of Paleolithic paintings in Cave of Forgotten Dreams. He remade F.W. Murnau's creepy 1922 silent vampire film Nosferatu. And in his documentary Grizzly Man, Herzog introduced us to Timothy Treadwell, who believed he could live with and protect Alaskan bears with tragic consequences.
Treadwell is gone. The argument how wrong or how right he was disappears into a distance, into a fog. What remains is his footage.
For fans like indie filmmaker David Frederick, it's Herzog's bold cinematic style and arresting voice that help make him a singular storyteller.
It's crucial. He's kind of like the guide. I mean, every film is a pilgrimage with him, and he just kind of just takes you on that journey, and you're bound to him, I guess.
It's very precise, very intense, very calm, and delivered in a way that you really listen.
Maybe it doesn't need to be said, but that's Herzog. And he says it took time to find his voice. The filmmaker recalls making his 1974 ski jumping documentary, The Great Ecstasy of the Woodcarver Steiner, where, as he puts it, he was forced to narrate on camera.
Der letzte Sprung und Sturz, den Sie gerade gesehen haben, war von Walter Steiner, 1973.
I hated it at the time, but I learned something. If I left myself as a person out of it and I only had my voice, it was kind of effective. And it's not just the voice, it's what I'm saying and the kind of authenticity that comes across because I speak my own texts. One of these disoriented or deranged penguins showed up at the New Harbor diving camp, already some 80 kilometers away from where it should be.
Herzog's scripts are philosophical, poetic, probing, personal, and irreverent. He started making movies as a teen in Bavaria with a stolen 35mm camera and went on to capture dozens of real and fictional narratives driven by curiosity and human folly. Herzog's far-flung locations and techniques are often extreme, some say insane. While making his 1976 feature film Heart of Glass, he hypnotized his actors. For 1982's Fitzcarraldo, he required the cast and crew to haul an actual steamship over a hill in the Peruvian jungle.
Pull it!
Crazy or not, Herzog says his cinematic vision has always been clear.
I think that I can see and articulate things that others do not see yet and cannot articulate yet, but I have it in me in a way.
That might sound lofty, but somehow coming from Herzog, it's not. As for how he finds his ideas for film projects, Herzog explains, as only Herzog can, that they come to him without warning and with great vehemence.
You wake up in the middle of the night because something is stirring in your kitchen, and it's 3 a.m, and you all of a sudden discover there are 5 burglars, and one of them comes at you swinging wildly, so you better deal with that one first.
Herzog seeks out curious, passionate characters, often on quests of their own. Then there's Herzog's use of music. Take Into the Inferno, his 2016 documentary about the scientific and spiritual connections people around the globe have with active volcanoes. In it, he juxtaposes visceral, violent nature footage with emotional choral and opera works.
Whenever this music is paired with events of flowing, very, very dangerous lava, it acquires a quality of fever dreams, of something that's outside of us.
Cinema's spell, Herzog says, is always on him.
Cinema, deep inside in its very nature, is something awesome. The awe at what we are seeing, what I'm doing, gives me great joy and insight, and it's my connection to life itself.
At 75 years old, the filmmaker says digital technology helps him to be more productive now than when he was young. He released 3 films in 2016. These days, Herzog says he's working on a bunch of projects, including a documentary about the last leader of the Soviet Union.
At the moment, I will continue filming with Mikhail Gorbachev. He wants to meet me again. I think he kind of likes me.
Herzog assures me he's not a workaholic. So I ask what he does to unwind.
I'm always unwound.
For Here and Now, I'm Andrea Shea.
President Trump said today that the U.S. could soon impose steep new tariffs on steel imports. Trump wants to set a 24% tariff on steel and a 10% one on aluminum imports. The details of Trump's plan are still unclear, but at a meeting with industry leaders today, the president said, quote, "We'll be signing it next week." Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News, and he joins us now. And Mike, what more do we know, if anything, about when these tariffs could be implemented and who might they have an impact on?
Well, as you said, Trump plans to sign it next week. It's unclear exactly when they would go into force. We'll have to see the document he signs next week. But as far as the trading partners, I mean, it's some of the biggest U.S. trading partners out there. Mexico, Canada, Brazil, Russia, Germany, and China all export a lot of steel to the U.S. So it's a pretty broad swath of our trading partners that would be affected.
Wow. By what sounds like a major tariff, if the 24% proposal does go through. I mean, so what kind of pushback could there be, if any, from these partners, these trading partners?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Right after Trump said this, there was a report in a German newspaper that said the European Union could react within days with counter tariffs on U.S. products, ranging from everything from orange juice to Harley Davidson's and whiskey. And China has already launched a probe into U.S. imports of sorghum, and it's studying whether to restrict shipments of U.S. soybeans. So it's clear that the trading partners will be prepared and likely react to this if it does go into force.
Aha. Uh-huh. So we will see. Okay. Right. Well, let's shift gears a little, because we're also following the second appearance before Congress this week of the new chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell. He took over, of course, from former Fed Chair Janet Yellen in early February. Today, he appeared before the Senate Banking Committee, and he was asked to comment about tariffs.
I think, you know, as Chairman Bernanke said, the tariff approach is not the best approach there. The best approach is to deal directly with the people who are affected rather than falling back on tariffs, which but again, these are not measures that are consigned to us. They're really for you and for the administration.
But I think
so. Translation: he doesn't think it's a good idea, but thank goodness the Fed doesn't have to deal with it.
well, right. I think he's not alone in his opinion that it's not a good idea. There's been a lot of pushback. The Institute for Supply Management is out saying it's not a good idea, that U.S. steel plants just don't have the capacity right now to handle the extra demand.
Okay. Well, Powell, though, overall seems pretty positive about the economy. On Tuesday, he was before the House Financial Services Committee, and he said he's not that concerned about a possible recession, but he hinted that there could be several rate increases this year because the economy is so strong. So tell us more about that.
Yeah, right. And the stock market didn't react very well to that. Obviously, Wall Street doesn't want higher rates, at least from the stock market angle. One thing he said today that caught a lot of attention is he said he doesn't believe the U.S. economy is overheating. In other words, it's not getting so hot that inflation will get out of control and sort of cause more bubbles in asset prices and create a situation where we'd have a really hard landing down the road. So Wall Street sort of fixated on that because it indicates that he will likely continue on the path of gradual interest rate increases, but he won't sort of get more aggressive in order to prevent an overheating of the economy.
It's Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, helping us read the Fed tea leaves, as always. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Megan.
Scene from the Marvel blockbuster Black Panther, the story of a young king in the secret fictional African kingdom of Wakanda, at once both ancient and amazingly advanced, the first big-budget superhero film with a majority African-American cast, characters who can be both good and evil, and then there are the costumes. Indiana Pacers guard Victor Oladipo wore a Black Panther mask during an all-star dunk contest. The Carolina Panthers commissioned illustrators to reimagine their uniforms Black Panther-style. People are putting together Wakanda sports leagues. Stores that rent traditional African clothing for weddings are seeing clothing fly off the racks as people rent or buy them to wear to the theaters. And then there's cosplayers, costume players who dress up as sci-fi and anime characters for play and conventions. There are fewer women in the cosplay world, even fewer people of color, but now they have the Black Panther characters. Tamara Heredia is a Black 29-year-old cosplayer from Houston. She's been wearing tribal face paints inspired by Black Panther and is working on a Black Panther costume. Tamara, what has Black Panther meant for you?
Okay, well, for me, Black Panther was such a big deal because I had never seen powerful Black women portrayed, like, anywhere, really. So to see them be, like, the leaders of Wakanda was really, really powerful for me.
We have the king's son's mother, Angela Bassett, playing Ramondo. You have his sister, Shuria. You have the different spies and guards. It really is quite awesome. And talk about not just how they present themselves. But what about what they're wearing? Breastplates and lots of leather and lots of golden cuff bracelets. Talk more about what it looks like.
So the outfits themselves, each of the different Dora Milaje, the women warriors, have different details to their armor. So we have the gold or the silver armor on the arms. That's been molded. I believe we talked to Ruth, who did the costume work on the actual set of the movie. It's rubberized. So
Wait a minute. You talked to the woman who did the costume work on the set?
Yes, ma'am. She has joined a group of Black Panther cosplayers, and she's been basically helping us and talking us through rebuilding or recreating the cosplays.
How did you contact her?
She appeared in our group. They're like, "Welcome, Ruth." And we were like, "Hello, Ruth. Is this real life?" So
you talk about groups. I want to get back to more of what you heard from the costume designer. But talk about these groups that many African-American cosplayers have created because, you really are a minority in this world of cosplaying. What are some of the groups that you're in?
I'm in the extraordinary journey of a Black nerd. Name is really long. I'm also in POC cosplayers.
POC people of color.
Mm-hmm. And then Texas Melanin Geeks.
This is incredible. And so into one of these wanders the real costume designer from this extraordinary film. She tells you about pulling from different African countries for some of her inspiration. What else did she tell you?
Like, we were really stressing ourselves over the tabards that they have is all hand beaded. So we were wondering if did they really truly sit there and hand bead these the world's tiniest beads, or did they come up with some kind of quick way to do it? But no, it was all 100% hand beaded. At this point, I think we've hand beaded over 700 beads, and we're not done yet.
Well, tell us more about what this means to you. This is authentic.
It really reminds me that somebody cared enough to get the details down that were culturally correct. The fact that they took these elements and put them into the movie, it made a fictional world still have deep roots to, you know, our current world.
Right. And to your past. But on the flip side of that, speak to the fact that many minorities in the cosplay world have been trolled because in the past you have dressed up as white characters. You're not saying that you're giving up your right to do that as well.
No, not at all. I'm just excited that I can portray a black character because I have cosplayed non-black characters and heard the ridicule like, you know, oh, you're a black Power Girl. No, I'm just Power Girl, you know, or, oh, you're a black Wonder Woman. No, I'm just Wonder Woman. It's because it's what we look like. Do you know what
and
I mean?
How would you feel if I shouldn't say if, because we are also seeing young white people wanting to dress up like the Black Panther characters. How does that hit you?
Go for it. I think the biggest concern is that you, as far as like doing the facial markings with the paint and the scarifications that are traditional African traditions, I think that would be the most conflicting component. Because these face paintings and these decorative face art, it means a lot more to the African community and the African American community. So like for me, I did do some tribal face paints, but I also got in contact with friends and family that I know from African tribes. So I avoided certain shapes and certain patterns so not to offend anyone, because I may be African American, but I don't know anything really about my African roots.
Yeah. Well, maybe now you will.
Yeah.
know more. And I'm wondering, obviously, I hear the pride from you. I hear how exciting and fun it is. I'm wondering, will it transfer to other things? You know, we're hearing about shops in primarily African American communities that rent out authentic African clothing for things like weddings, people who want to return to those roots. And now people are renting clothing from there to go to see the movie. Is this something, do you think, because you're obviously so comfortable dressing up, is this something that you might incorporate more in your life?
I'm not sure. For me, I started trying to find like the African community in Houston to try to get in touch with those roots of mine. So I feel as though when I become more culturally aware, that I might feel more inclined to dress like that.
Right. Mimo, have you dressed up at the movie?
Yes, I did. I had a friend go to Nigeria, and she brought back some fabric for me. And so I made a movie premiere dress out of that fabric. But it was important that I supported either an African shop or African-American shops.
Well, and for your cosplay, you're going for Nakia. This is Lupita Nyong'o's character.
Yes, ma'am.
And I'm looking at a picture of her now. Again, we'll have them at herenow.org. She's got the breastplate and this heavy jewelry around her neck. How else are you going for her look?
So in order to do the necklaces, I'll give you like a little bit of secret as to what Ruth told us. They're actual rubber, like rubber tubing.
No.
Yeah, it's rubber tubing that they created the necklaces of. So we looked online and we found a few shops and we bought very similar tubing. And we're attaching the tubing to a piece of felt fabric so that it's more comfortable and it's easy on and off.
And what about the hair?
Her hairstyle is what's called a Bantu knot. So you twist and twist your hair until it makes little cinnamon buns, basically. And that's how she creates that look.
And I guess you have some other friends who are going for it's almost the Maasai warrior look of one of the guards. No
yes.
hair.
Yes, ma'am. Okoye is one of the characters that my friend is cosplaying as. She's and, a little bit stressed about the wig cap situation.
She's going to wear a wig cap.
Yeah, she can't bring herself to shave her head. I say go team shave, but, you know, it's not my hair.
Look, it's so much fun, but it's also sounding pretty powerful. I'm just wondering, you know, is there a moment where it hits you?
Yeah, there was a moment when we were putting on all the pieces that we've been working on, and just like seeing it on one of the girls is just like, whoa, like I feel so powerful and I feel so strong. And then I think about all the little kids that haven't seen, you know, like black superheroes or powerful black women, you know. So for me, it's like this is a chance for me to maybe even do charity work and touch these kids that haven't seen themselves and heroes.
Hmm. I could see you showing up in a hospital ward. That would really make somebody's day.
Yeah, I know. Could you imagine?
Well, go for it.
I know. I hope to. I hope to.
That's Tamara Heredia, a cosplayer from Houston, and expect to see her somewhere soon in her Black Panther outfits. Tamara, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
News about healthcare has basically disappeared under an avalanche of other stories coming out of Washington, so let's get up to speed. You'll remember that back in December, the GOP tax bill repealed the individual mandate that required that all Americans have health insurance. That change goes into effect in 2019. And now, the Trump administration is looking at other changes. One proposal would remove some restrictions on short-term health insurance. Joining us now to talk about the proposal is Allison Kojak, health policy correspondent for NPR. Hi there, Allison.
Hi, Magda.
So first of all, can you explain to us what are the basic differences between short-term insurance and other more common forms of health insurance?
Well, I mean, the most obvious difference is the duration of the policy. Yeah. A short-term policy under the Affordable Care Act can last only 3 months and it can't be renewed. But the more important difference is that these short-term plans don't have to follow the rules of the ACA. And many of those rules are pretty popular. These are the things that say you have to cover people who have pre-existing conditions or you have to pay for mental health insurance. They don't have minimum benefits. They can charge people more if they have health issues or can deny them altogether. So these are actually the insurance policies that the Affordable Care Act was kind of designed to get rid of.
I see.
And sometimes people think they have insurance, but when they need it, it doesn't cover their medical issues.
Okay. So if they only cover a person for a short period of time and there are things that the policies may not cover at all, who's buying these plans? Who's the market for these plans?
Well, right now, the market tends to be for people who are sort of between jobs and not during an open enrollment period. So they get something that'll cover them if something really bad happens in an interim period when they don't have insurance. And so that's why they were allowed to stay in business, these companies that sell these plans, after the Affordable Care Act passed.
I see. So they fill a hole there. That
yeah, there's
that
like
needs...
a stopgap.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But back to the point that you were making a little earlier, that the ACA limited the use of these short-term insurance plans to just 3 months. But I understand that the Trump administration is looking at expanding that to a year.
Exactly.
And so
exactly.
So why the expansion?
Well, what they're talking about, when you talk to people in the Trump administration, HHS Secretary Alex Azar, for example, will say that these policies will offer people a less expensive alternative to Affordable Care Act insurance. Under the ACA, they're not actually considered insurance. So at this moment, you still would have to pay the penalty under the Affordable Care Act if you only own one of these plans. But after 2019, you wouldn't have to pay that penalty. So what they're saying is, for some people, the Affordable Care Act insurance that covers things like mental health care, prescription drugs, maternity care, is too expensive, and these will give people who are healthy and don't need too much coverage a good alternative.
Okay, this is interesting. So from the perspective of the health insurance providers, I mean, what companies are providing these plans? Is it the major insurers that we might be familiar with?
It's a little bit of everybody. I mean, you will definitely have companies like United Healthcare that offers a short-term plan that complies with the current law, meaning it can only be for 3 months, and may offer more of these if this Trump administration proposal goes through. You also have some of these companies that you've never heard of because it's not considered specifically health insurance. Other companies can provide them. And the reason companies want to is because they make a big profit out of them. You know, they charge you something per month. I actually went online to look at some myself, and I was offered plans for like $160 for $200 a month. But they don't cover much. I mean, they would pay $50 for my first visit to a doctor. They wouldn't cover prescriptions at all. They'd pay 80% of hospitalizations after a $5,000 deductible. So if you buy one and you think it's going to be comprehensive insurance, that's not what it's going to be. And these companies like them because they don't pay out a lot. When I did make an inquiry, I got about 30 phone calls from brokers in less than 24 hours because these plans make money.
Wow. Okay. Now, the Trump administration is estimating that a few hundred thousand people may be interested in buying these plans. Mm-hmm. The Urban Institute, though, it looks like they're estimating that it could be around 2.5 million people. So quite a broad range there.
But, sure is.
What effect could, say it's on the 2.5 million end of things, what effect could it have on the broader health insurance market as a whole?
Well, obviously, there's a big debate because you can tell by those numbers.
Yeah.
The issue is if lots and lots of people leave the Affordable Care Act marketplaces and choose these cheaper plans, it could make insurance under the ACA, these comprehensive insurance, much more expensive.
Yeah.
Because the people who leave will be the healthy people who don't need much health care. And you're left in one pool, the less healthy people. Now, the Trump administration doubts that will happen because under the Affordable Care Act, people get a lot of subsidies to buy this better, more expensive, yet more comprehensive insurance. So for those people, their costs probably won't go up because the government pays for the difference. So they think that the ACA market as it stands is somewhat protected because of the government subsidy. So, you know, it remains to be seen how much effect it actually has on the marketplace.
Huh. Well, NPR health policy correspondent Allison Kojak, thank you so much, Allison.
Thanks so much for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.